Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron McKeefrey, and this is episode number 192. Excited to have Brian Schilling with us. Brian is the chair of the Department of Kinesiology and Nutrition Sciences at UNLV. He's worked with Air Force Special Forces. He's worked with UFC fighters. He's done a lot of different things, mostly in the tactical and combat athlete space. And then obviously runs a great program out there at UNLV, and wanted to have him on the show. We talked quite a bit about the balance of doing research and being a practitioner. I think there's tons of great stuff there. I think there's an area that we need to improve on as strength coaches is continuing to push the bar there, continuing to try to support some of the things that we're doing, and also listen to some of the data that's coming out. We talked quite a bit about athletes that have this mindset of, pushing until they want to puke and pushing too far. It's real common in the tactical and combat athlete space, and being able to navigate that and help them understand that there's a plan and a periodization model that needs to occur. And just a ton, we talk about flywheel training and eccentric loading and this idea of reactive strength. And so there's just really a ton of great information in there. Before we get to it, though, we want to make sure we recognize our sponsor for this episode, VersaPulley. I have one of these in my garage. Absolutely love it. This idea of reactive strength, being able to, create a concentric or an eccentric load, be able to reverse that concentrically and do it in three-dimensional space. It's been fantastic, and there's tons of products that are starting to pop up on the market, and eccentric flywheel training is starting to be kind of a hot topic in a lot of circles. But I think it's important that we understand it. Two, I think it's a fantastic alternative, adding variety as an external resistance for a lot of the exercises that we're doing. And so what I like about VersaPulley is the fact that, it can be put at the rack. It can be added on to a lot of exercises that we're already doing and adding a different stimulus, but then also be able to do things in a three-dimensional space adds to the amount of stuff that we can do at the rack. So I would encourage you guys to check them out, VersaPulley. They'll be at many of the play summits that we got going on this year, and Kirsten and everybody out there they're fantastic people. So check them out, follow them on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, and see a lot of the cool things that they're putting out lately. So want to get to this episode with Brian. Sit back and enjoy, and we'll see you on the other side. All right, guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. Excited to have Brian Schilling with us. I'm just getting to know Brian, but we just had a fantastic conversation off camera, and I've followed him from afar, we're in the same circles in a lot of ways, and just doing great things. He's a chair of kinesiology and nutrition sciences at UNLV. He works with Air Force Special Operations. He works with UFC fighters. So very eclectic, very busy man.
Right.
And has to run here in a little bit as well to a meeting, but wanted to have him on the show while we're here at the NSCA conference. So appreciate it, man. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for being here. Yeah, glad to be here.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, just for the people that are just to get to know you, Reader's Digest version. Take us back to the Winona State days.
Yeah.
And what got you into strength and conditioning and kinesiology and sports science, and how that's led to your current role.
Okay. I went to Winona State. I was the type of place where I thought I could play for a guy my size, Division II, and it was great experience. I was injured a lot, which actually got me in, because I was always undersized, so I was always trained to get bigger. Right. Then I started getting injured a lot, and then I thought, is there a way for me to stay in shape or, be able to play when I come back from these injuries, a lot of, lower extremity injuries. And it kind of evolved from there. I got really into I had really great professors there in exercise science, and they pushed me on to get my master's degree. at the time I thought, you know, I was going to be a strength coach, so I went for the Masters, but then I got involved in research with Mike Stone at Appalachian, and then I kind of was in this place where, you know, am I going to be a strength coach, am I going to be a researcher? I did a little bit of both. I did some internships at Olympic training centers, one kind of in a sports science side, and then one as a strength conditioning coach. So yeah. I had those options open, but it just, I guess my curiosity or whatever, and maybe the role models I had as professors led me down that end, and that's where I ended up.
Yeah. Yeah, we were both in Brian Mann's presentation earlier today and talking about the balance of understanding the science and constantly creating testing your ideals and what you're doing. So many times research is supporting what we already know from a practitioner side. We just don't, you know, we just haven't had it proven yet consistently and reliably.
Right, right.
You know, and so many times we're doing things that aren't really working. And once we realize it through data, we change our minds.
Right,
you know,
right.
As a young strength coach, you had this balance of, do I go down the coaching route or do I go down the academic route? You kind of chose the academic route, but then you blended it back with strength and conditioning. I think that's so important to have guys like yourself and Dr. Mann and others that are pushing the envelope there. But how have you been able to balance? I mean, most people will say, okay, well, you know, how much do you really know about strength and conditioning if you've been in
right,
the classroom
right,
this whole
right,
time?
Right, right.
You've been actually practicing, you know, being a practitioner simultaneously. But how important has that been for you to become the best strength coach?
It's been hugely important. And, you know, I had some real hard struggles along the way because I knew really good coaches that really maybe didn't get into the academic side. And then we were talking about it, you know, so many people that had all the head knowledge but then couldn't actually put it into practice. So that's right. Kind of with a soapbox that I'm on right now is really, how good are we doing at bridging the gap? And unfortunately, I feel like a lot of the academics that I know, they want to blame the practitioners. Well, the stuff is out there. Why do you didn't read it? I'm like, well, maybe you didn't write it well enough sure. that somebody could understand it. I teach scientific writing, so that's one of the things I really try to get across to my students is like, look, write for your audience. If you're writing in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, your audience should be the practitioner. It shouldn't be somebody else who's just going to cite it.
Sure.
You know, get some, you know, and bridge that gap. So, you know, that's the thing that I'm big on right now. So I gave a presentation at the TSAC conference. Was it 2 years ago or last year? But it was all about this idea of evidence-based practice and how that worked. The first thing I got up there and said is like, look, I am not a strength coach. I am not a full-time strength coach. So feel free to challenge me, strength coaches, if I say something that doesn't apply because I'm not a strength coach.
Right.
But I know this end of it, and if we will talk, we can figure this out.
Right. You know, and I think that, I mean, I know where you're coming from with that, but sometimes I get frustrated with that because it should go both ways. Like, you are a strength coach. Just like I, as a strength coach, should be a scientific,
right,
you know,
right.
I should be a practicing sports scientist,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's, as Brian made a great point, that we need to be doing more together and pushing this profession forward by collaborating more. If we, as strength coaches, have, you know, subjects and ideas, mm-hmm. we should be bringing those forthright to the academics and
yep.
vice versa. You know?
Yep.
And guys like yourself, I'm preaching to the choir because you're doing that on a daily basis. But what would be your advice, you know, because you are a strength coach, to strength coaches on how to get more involved with putting out quality research?
I mean, I think the main thing is just forming the relationship. You know, go to your university and go to, you know, Joe's office in academics and see if he's interested. And if he's not, find somebody else who is. And then the other thing is to not write them off either. You know, some, you know, relationships change, things change. I've been across the different universities. I've seen coaches come and go. I've had places, you know, when I first got to the University of Memphis, strength and conditioning would have nothing to do with us. They wouldn't want us anywhere near there. And I was a weightlifter at the time. I was just looking for a place to go train every
sure.
once in a while. They didn't even want us in the building. But then, you know, then that staff changes, and then the relationship goes the other way. So one of the first things I did when I got to UNLV is I started calling the strength coaches. You know, call Keith, call Jason, like, let's get these guys, call the trainers in the area.
Right.
Like, I want to have that relationship, and I want it to be a cultural thing where it's not just personal. It's like, no, this is what we do here, and when people change, it's still going to be the culture. This is still going to be what we're
right.
We're going to work together somehow.
You know, one of your initiatives at UNLV is to up the standard of what, you know,
right.
what comes in.
Mm-hmm.
One of your ways of upping that is by increasing the opportunities that your students have through internships. Strength and conditioning, obviously internships are a major part of that experience and that kind of rite of passage and the whole deal. What are you looking for, you know, for that student, you know, for these different coaches out there that are running internships, as an academic, as a chair of a department, what constitutes a great experience for that student?
That's a great question. I like to see some structure under the constraints of, it's the athletics, and there's going to be some structure. Like, this is kind of our onboarding process. This is how you get to, this is what I'm going to expect with you when you're done. One of the things that I look at is I want our internship experience to be a culminating experience. So when I send a person to you for an intern, I want them to be like a mini professional.
Right.
They're about ready to graduate and they're going to go into the real world. So I want you to push them on that, because that's what's good. I want you to push them. It's like, this is not just something you do and then you're gone. This is it. You're putting the rubber to the road right now.
Right.
So that's one of the things I'd be looking at for an experience, is, you know, getting them involved as a mini professional.
Yeah.
Puts responsibility on me to make sure I'm not sending you a person who's not going to, you know, contribute.
Right.
I don't want it to be a time suck for you. I want it to be a mutual thing.
Sure. I think flipping that then, coming into a new university, I think you've been there just a couple months.
Six months now.
What are you doing? What was from an initiative to make strength and conditioning more of a part of the kinesiology department?
I think it's just a matter of just being involved in the NSCA. Typically, the academics have a little more time latitude in what we're doing, and the coaches are already covered up. And Jason Cable has been there forever, and he's working like a crazy man. He's working so hard. So I trying to really reach out and say, hey, look, what can we do for you? And not looking at it as a self-serving thing, like,
sure,
hey, this is what I can do for you. It's like, no, what can I do for
give,
you? You know,
give,
yeah,
give,
what can I? How can I help? And how can it be mutual? UNLV got a couple big donations, and I'm sure there are a lot of people coming by expecting to get a handout. I'm like,
sure.
Look, I'm not coming for a handout. I'm trying to see if there's something we can do. We've got these 1,500 students that need an experience, and
right.
We've got good master's students. We've got good faculty. We've got facilities. We've got research equipment that we can use. You know, we don't work for you, but
right.
we can work with you.
Sure.
You know, so to help you do that. So that's kind of what I'm looking for right now.
You know, flipping gears a little bit with actually getting into more of the practicing side of strength and conditioning. You work with, you know, special forces, you work with fighters.
Mm-hmm.
Both those groups have a mentality about mm-hmm. them that it's go, go, go. And then when you finally are puking your guts out and you can't do anything else,
yeah.
that's when it's
yeah.
time to stop.
Yeah.
You know, how have you been able to manage and kind of teach them that there has got to be a periodization plan, and there's got to be ebb and flow,
yeah.
and there's got to be
that's
good, to recovery.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. I mean, most of my work with these groups is not from a coaching standpoint. That's more from a research standpoint. So the moral of the story is I really go and try to get information out of them. You know, why do you feel like you need to do that to be gassed or whatever? And so far, you know, like I said, the benefit of me working with all these individual populations is there's always been somebody on the ground there that was great.
Right.
You know, Matt Parvis is with the PJs up at Nellis there, and he's been really, really good about, you know, this is how we can gather some data. The whole Air Force has been great to work with. Like I said, I'm not a coach. My role is just the research end of it. But they're great as far as, like, you know, thinking about things of how, you know, we can help them from being located there. On the fighter end of it, it's kind of two things. It's working with, it's basically selling the idea of longevity from them. You know, if you get hurt, you can't fight, there's no payday. So let's
right.
let's train smart and still be ready to you know, go to war when getting in the octagon. And then it's the two things. It's getting, you know, getting that payday. Then it's also about staying active longer. Can you be a fighter longer? I've got some friends that are involved in different parts of the military, and it's interesting to me if, you know, you train a guy to be a high-level operator, even if his body breaks down, which it will, because you can't go through that training and those deployments without getting broken down, you can't replicate what's in his head because of the experience that he has.
Right.
So keeping that guy active longer and not burning him out so he doesn't want anything to do with it, maybe he becomes part of the cadre and he's teaching whatever, I think that's an invaluable thing for how we're going to keep those forces strong in the long term.
Sure. You know, when you've dealt with those guys, obviously behavior change is always, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is altering those behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
What are some tactics that you, I mean, obviously you mentioned showing them their mortality in the sport tactic.
Yeah, yeah.
What are some other tactics that you've used?
I think some of the tactics that I've used, and I had to learn this the hard way, is going in with a lot of humility.
Yeah.
Is going in there and saying, you know, I don't have all the answers. I think a lot of maybe academics have that wrong attitude. It's like, here's what you need to do. I'm
right.
like, I don't know, man.
It's in a textbook.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I don't, you know, you tell me what you need.
Right.
So that I think that's been a lot of it. And the other thing is, can't bullshit these people. Right. The fighters and these SF guys, their detectors are pretty good.
Yeah, sure.
So if you don't know the answer, you say, you know what, I don't know, but let me see if I can find out.
That's exactly right. And I think that's something that can be said even with athletes, you know, of any sport.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to show a human side of you and say
absolutely.
That you don't have the answer.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, my wife's a dietitian, and one of the things that really hurt registered dietitians for a long time is they just said, don't take supplements. Why? I don't know. Just don't take supplements.
Yeah,
and she'll admit it too. And it wasn't that answer. Like, you know, I don't know about that.
Right.
Let me look into it.
So sure.
It's black and white thinking, you really get them anywhere with that.
You and I both are proponents of flywheel training, and it's kind of making a comeback. Mm-hmm. And, I'm a big fan of VersaPulley. I know you are as well. Explain flywheel training a little bit, and then you did a lot of research. Kind of, how have you found it to be a useful in sport?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the benefits you get is being able to do things that are more rotational in nature without just having to throw something. So if you don't have room to throw a ball or something like that, you can do things that are more rotational in nature. And the other thing is the obvious benefit is training variety.
Right.
Now, variety for variety's sake is
resistance. Right.
Yeah, we've had variety for variety's sake, and it's been really hard on our profession.
Right.
It's like, well, do this. Why? Well, because it's different. Well,
right.
Just because it's different doesn't mean it's good.
Great.
But in the flywheel training, I think you've got a useful mechanism that is slightly different.
Right.
Especially you talk about long-term development. Guys have been doing this barbell dumbbell training for so long now, it gives them a different avenue to train, or an avenue to train around an injury that they couldn't maybe do with a traditional resistance device.
Right.
But it's still effective. It's not just doing something to do something different.
Sure. And in terms of, obviously working in the transverse plane and rotational exercises, mm-hmm. but, you know, also, you're talking about the stimulus of eccentric load,
right.
And things along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find anything in your research to really kind of be more of a, is it less, better?
At least as good. We actually retrofitted a VersaPulley to do more front squatting motion.
Right.
What we found out is that with the adjustability of the speed and the resistance on the cone, you're actually able to maintain like a flatter power output over
right.
across these different ranges of loading. So it was kind of interesting that ultimately it still appears to be an effective stimulus, but it is slightly different, especially like with the eccentric loading, that you can
right.
put energy in that system and then pull it out quicker. It just takes a little bit of learning on how to maximize that training device.
Absolutely. You know, when you go into all these different jobs that you've had, and you because you're spread so thin, you know, with different camps,
mm-hmm.
you're obviously going to make mistakes. You know, we all
absolutely,
make mistakes.
Absolutely.
You know, what's one of the biggest mistakes you ever made, and kind of how you learned from it?
Boy, that's like a whole podcast
yeah,
in of itself. When I think about all of the
not
things.
Not today.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem I had was the biggest mistake I made was not being in the moment enough, not really realizing the experiences I was having and benefiting from, because I was always looking towards the next thing.
Sure.
And looking back, you know, and maybe that's just a sign of getting older, right, getting more mature. But you know, when I look back at the athletes I had the pleasure of coaching and being around, and I don't think I let it sink in enough, because I was thinking about where I was going to go next.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, being a dad now and getting older, I think it really, I look back, I mean, I really wish I could have soaked that up a little bit more.
Right.
So I guess my advice is that, you know, be mindful of where you're at and your experiences, good and bad, and, you know, realize that, you know, things will get better even when they suck, and,
right.
and you know, stop saying why me and think about what can I learn from this, and then move on from there.
Right. Yeah, I mean, everybody listens to the show, they know that I talk about it quite a bit, but one of my favorite books is Make the Big Time Where You're At. And, you know, whenever you focus purely 100% on where you're at and you make it the big time,
right.
then
right.
it makes those decisions clearer.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yep.
if it's that much better, money-wise, time-wise, whatever, then it's, you know, hey, it is what it is. But.
Yep.
You know, your obligation is to your employer to make the big time where you're at.
Yeah.
It's also a way to, I think, to get to what you're saying is to embrace. I mean, I think about coaching in Tennessee or coaching in NFL Europe or coaching in Tampa Bay, you know, Tampa Bay. And, yeah, I remember running through the tee. And I remember them playing Rocky Top and, you know, and going to Berlin or Barcelona or whatever. But, you know. I was so focused on coaching that I didn't
yep.
appreciate it
yep.
in the moment, and I couldn't agree with you more. What about, you know, the best piece of coaching advice you ever received?
You know, working with Mike Stone had such an unbelievable knowledge of sports science, and it taught me so much, not just from the science aspect, but just from the mentoring standpoint about, you know, being a good person in this profession. But, you know, I knew very little about weightlifting, even as a college football coach. We had a power lifter for a coach. He was a great guy, Jeff Rinardi, by the way. Loved the man. But, you know, he wasn't a weightlifter, and I just didn't know much about it. We did some things and stuff. But, you know, working with Eric Lawson a little bit at the training center and then going out to Stone, it was hilarious because he said, that was a kind of a pseudo bodybuilder powerlifter type. It's like, look, you don't have to be a competitive weightlifter. Come down to the weight room when the track and field athletes are down here and learn the lifts so you understand them. You can conceptualize them.
Right.
And probably within a week of that, I was thinking about how am I going to qualify for the national championships in weightlifting. And I was, you know, and I went all in. I remember I was getting outlifted by a female shot putter that day. I mean, she was throwing up more weight overhead than I was. I couldn't even do an overhead squat.
That's awesome.
But one of the things he told me was that, you know, we as coaches sometimes compartmentalize stuff. Like, well, you need work on your movements, you know, your mobility, or you need movement on you need work on your strength, or you need work on your flexibility or your speed. The cool thing about weightlifting is that those things are all there and they're not individual.
Yeah.
Strength influences speed. If you are not, if your movement is bad, you can't get into a position to express force correctly. And so by not compartmentalizing those different aspects of being an athlete, I think you can that's a good piece of coaching advice.
Absolutely.
I think some guys, you know, they latch onto the FMS and they become all about that, and I'm a strength guy, and not that I think that's unimportant, but I was like, when did we get strong? You know? And now if you have a mobility issue that prevents you from expressing force, then by all means, let's work on that. But let's not just try to put all our eggs into that basket. Let's talk about how those things influence one another.
Agreed. I think something else that you alluded to in there or talked about in there that I want to bring attention to was, here you are, you know, having played, having, you know, working on PhD and the whole deal, but now you went back and you became competitive in a sport, just to get that sense of competition, to understand.
It was a fantastic
goal setting, all those types of
things. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was new to me. I started as an official weightlifter. I guess I was 22, I guess, when I started weightlifting. But then I lifted all the way through my master's degree and all the way through my PhD. And pretty much at the time I graduated from my PhD, it was time to retire. First of all, I wasn't getting any better. I was getting older.
Right.
All these young kids were outlifting me. Plus, I was married now. It's expensive to go compete at these national events. Right. I still love weightlifting. Some of my great friends are weightlifters or involved in weightlifting. I still have a place in my heart for it. Weightlifters always treated me really well. When I was an intern at the Olympic Training Center, Dragomir and those guys let me train with them. So, man,
that's awesome.
I'm terrible, right? I mean, I'm probably, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm doing like 120 and... I wasn't even snatching one. I was probably doing like 110 and 135 at the time. And then, geez, there's Shane Hammond and Wes Barnett and Pete Kelly. And I'll never forget, I can't remember what I was doing. I was going for a PR or something like that. And the room stopped. I'm like, I don't know what to do right now. And I think I made it, whatever. It was like, God, these guys, they actually care about people. And they were supportive. It was awesome. It was a great experience.
Yeah, that's the thing I'm glad you said that story, because that's the thing when you're only an academic that you don't understand.
Right.
You know, that culture, that camaraderie. That's why, like you said, it's so important, especially for all the academics that are listening, and the ones that are, they're the good ones, but, you know, because you understand and you appreciate that. But those internships, it is so important to get out and get that practical experience, because you don't fully understand the culture until you submerge yourself in it. But to have those guys, I mean, that's a big deal. When somebody's going for a PR, that's a big deal.
Right. And it has to do with what you've done up to this point and what you're going to do after this point. It's a climax of that, you know, that training period or whatever, and then how you're going to plan ahead. It's an important event.
That's great, man. Well, last question is, give us a book, app, and website recommendation.
Well, yeah, I'm going to my book recommendation is going to be pretty far out there. You know, one of the things about science is that it has a philosophy. You know, when you get a PhD, you know, you say, what's your doctorate in? Well, it's in biomechanics. Well, no, it's not. It's in philosophy.
Sure.
It's a doctorate of philosophy in the philosophy of science.
Right.
Now, I specialize in a certain area, but it's the philosophy of science. And we, as academics, have gotten so far away from that. So my book recommendation is there's a book series called A Very Short Introduction.
Okay.
And there's A Very Short Introduction to the Philosophy of Science.
Really?
It's thick. I mean, it's this big, right? But, I mean, it's dense, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to go through and be like, okay, wait a minute. what the hell that's so you go again. But understanding the philosophy of science, for no matter where you are, understands what science can tell us, what it can't tell us.
Right.
You know, what can we support? How do we support things? How do we fail to support things? And the best part about it is it bridges into the philosophy of statistics, which is where we as academics are doing the worst job of letting people know what works or has potential to work or doesn't work.
Right.
We've gotten so far into these really bad statistical tests that don't really interpret the data. We give statistics, not results.
Yeah.
And so I think that book will really open some people's eyes. Yeah, and I've read it two or three times because you have to, because I'm telling you, it's dense. And it's not a textbook on philosophy. It's like a very short introduction to it. It's supposed to be a mass market type thing.
Really?
So that's a book.
Okay.
What was the other one? You said
website.
App and website. You know, one of the things that I've gotten into now, this is again kind of off the track, is the Strava app, which is just like for, you know, being in Vegas, the best part about it is there's 300 days of sunshine, and there's hiking and biking and walking and national parks everywhere. So it's like just kind of fun to see where you're at, look at the maps, and I got
shows elevation changes.
Yeah, exactly. I got a little trailer for my 4.5-year-old, and I throw her on the back there, and that's my workout. I was towing her around.
That's awesome.
So we drive up, and there's where we live, you're never more than a mile away from a park.
Yeah.
And they're all connected by trail, so you go on a bike, you can go anywhere in Henderson, Las Vegas. So I use Strava all the time. I got a little holder for my bike that I put my wallet and keys and knife and stuff in there, and I put my phone right on top and turn the Strava app, and then we go.
That's awesome. Website?
Ooh, that's a tough one. You know what? I'm gonna say the NSCA website, and because, you know,
done a much better job in recent years.
Absolutely. Sure. And here's the moral of the story, people. It's like, You can bash an organization, but organization is made up of people, and that's why it's never going to be perfect.
Membership brand. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, look, there are plenty of imperfect organizations because we're made of people, and people aren't perfect. But the NSCA is still the best organization out there. Does it have flaws? Absolutely. But there are a lot of passionate people who really care about the profession and the science of strength and conditioning, and they're working hard on the members' behalf. So I plug them.
Well, man, this has been great, and you know, like I said at the beginning, we're lucky as a profession to have a guy like yourself in the profession, blending the science with the practice,
doing it
at a high level, and not only doing that, but then turn around and giving it back by speaking at GSAC and these events. So, man, really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your information. And,
awesome.
And
anytime. Glad to do it.
Hang out with you more. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.